Wildfires out west burning out of control. Around the globe, firefighters mobilizing to help.
In Quebec, we were able to respond with 60 firefighters that were available. They've done it across Canada, and just last winter, many went to Australia to help out as well.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, protests against police brutality in Colombia's capital turned deadly.
The city seems to be like a pot of hot water that is starting to boil over.
And scientists mapping the seafloor under the so-called Doomsday Glacier in Antarctica make a discovery.
The amount of warm water that we can get from the deeper ocean right underneath that ice shelf to melt it is actually higher than we had previously thought.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Good to have you with us. We begin today's show at the bottom of the world. Thwaites Glacier in Antarctica has a nickname, the Doomsday Glacier, because it's the biggest wild card on Earth for the future of sea level rise. It's melting faster and faster. Research published this week shows that underwater valleys leading up to the glacier are much deeper than previously thought, which means it might melt faster still. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler explains why.
On a foggy morning in February of 2019, scientists gathered giddily on the top deck of a research ship just off the coast of Antarctica.
The sonars are doing good stuff right now. So.
After a month at sea, they'd finally reached the front of Thwaites Glacier. A wall of ice 6 or 7 stories tall was right there. It's just the front edge of a glacier the size of Florida that stretches hundreds of miles inland into Antarctica. Rob Larder from the British Antarctic Survey was on deck.
We've been telling everybody this is where rapid change is really happening, and we're actually standing and looking at the bit that's rapidly changing.
Thwaites stabilizes the entire West Antarctic ice sheet, slowing the river of ice that's constantly flowing out to sea. And Thwaites is melting fast. If it were to disappear, it could push global sea levels up about 2 feet and trigger much more melting. This was the first time humans had ever sailed along the front of the glacier. Chief Mate Rick Wimkin was navigating carefully along its craggy front.
Main thing here is to just keep a safe distance away from the glacier edge and still able to get them their first swath of multi-beam data.
When he says multi-beam, he means data that comes from sonar, sound waves used to chart the seafloor. As the ship sailed along the front of the glacier, it mapped the bottom of the underwater topography there for the first time.
Getting some uncharted data for the scientists here.
Several decks below, one of those scientists was in the scientific command center of the ship. British Antarctic Survey marine geophysicist Kelly Hogan was looking not out of the portholes at the glacier, but at a computer screen, making sure the sonar pinging away was capturing all the underwater valleys underneath the ship.
So one of our primary goals is to look specifically at some of those deep channel areas and try to map out where they get close to Thwaites.
Scientists thought those channels served as a pathway for warm water that sinks to the bottom of the seafloor, sending it toward the glacier.
And it's thought to be one of the major culprits for melting at Thwaites.
This week, the results of Hogan and her whole team's research from aboard the ship have finally been published. They mapped out a network of deep, connected channels that lead right to the glacier.
So we actually found that they were several hundred meters deeper than we thought they were. So if you imagine stacking the Statue of Liberty on herself 3 times over.
Sitting in her office in Cambridge in the UK, Hogan told me today that's important because the warmest water in Antarctica sinks to the bottom of the seafloor.
And what that really means is that the amount of warm water that we can get close to Thwaites Glacier to melt it is actually higher than we had previously thought.
That is not good news for the fate of Thwaites. And there's more. Part of the glacier lifts off the seafloor, and it floats. A plane flew over that floating portion of the ice to map the seafloor underneath it and found the deep channels continue. Here's Tom Jordan, an aerogeophysicist at the British Antarctic Survey.
We flew up and down, and we were actually measuring the strength of the Earth's gravitational field. So we can tell that these big channels really do continue.
That means they could deliver warm water right up to where Thwaites lifts off the seafloor. Another piece of early evidence suggests not only could this happen, but it looks like it is happening. A team of scientists, including David Holland from New York University, this past winter drilled through the floating part of ice to measure the water underneath it.
And the big takeaway was, what is the water temperature?
They'd suspected it would be warm, and it was.
When all is said and done and we make our measurement, we find the water temperature to be at 0 degrees centigrade. And for a glacier, that's a very untenable situation. That means the glacier is going to indeed melt rapidly.
As it's carved out from below, the glacier's underbelly will lose contact with more of the seafloor and act less like a break for the ice flowing off the continent. As it does that, more and more of Thwaites will spill into the ocean, pushing up sea levels. Knowing the contours of the underwater channels Kelly Hogan just mapped will help scientists figure out how much and how fast Thwaites will change our coastlines.
So now we have a really good baseline data set that tells us how big these channels are, how wide they are, how deep they are, and therefore we can go ahead and make those calculations and observations of how much warm water can get under the ice and melt it.
Work on Thwaites has largely been put on pause due to the pandemic. Scientists hope they may be able to send a small team to the ice this upcoming winter. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
The images from parts of California are enough to make you shudder.
The flames driven by gusty winds are choking the state in smoke and ash.
More than 24 wildfires turn the California skies into a sick shade of orange. In Butte County, Will Slessor had to evacuate his home.
A couple cars came up with their blue lights and their weird sirens, and they just said, everybody out.
Fires in Oregon and Washington are burning, too. Canada has sent several dozen firefighters to help out. Melanie Morin is with SOPFEU, a forest firefighting organization in Quebec.
So they left last Wednesday. They have a 14-day deployment on the fire line. They are currently in the Plumas National Forest, which is in Northern California.
Have you heard from any of them, and how have they described the conditions they're working under?
So we get daily reports. Everything is going quite well. The work that they're doing is appreciated. It's hard work, but again, this is what they went there to do. They've had challenging weather in the last few days, and their work has been adjusted accordingly.
Are these volunteers? I mean, how do they prepare for these kinds of missions?
So in Canada, there are no volunteer wildland firefighters. Firefighters belong to a provincial organization. In Quebec, we were able to respond with 60 firefighters that were available. They are paid. It is seasonal work. They are trained. They do this year after year. Many have been doing this for many years. They've done it across Canada. And even just last winter, many went to Australia to help out as well.
For the California mission, how did you select the 60 firefighters who went?
The ones that do get to go have to have passed their fitness test in the beginning of the season. Then there were certain requirements as to training and also bilingualism. So, yes, if there's a need for more, I imagine that we can definitely send more, but that is on a if-needed basis.
Do the Canadian firefighters work independently, or are they mixing together with American firefighters and anybody else who's coming in?
So this year is a particular year because of the current pandemic. There definitely would be more cooperation if we weren't in the pandemic. To mitigate the risk to COVID-19, the 60 firefighters from Quebec are being treated a bit as in a bubble. They do have a certain amount of interaction with a few California representatives that are there for training and for safety and for guiding purposes on the ground. But as for lodging and meals and their general day-to-day activities, they are within their own bubble and there's not as much cooperation as there have been on previous missions.
Melanie Morin with SOPFEU, that's a forest firefighting organization in Quebec. Melanie, thank you very much for speaking with us, and thank you very much for the help you're sending us down here.
Thank you.
The pandemic has slowed the global economy in a big way, and that means the demand for energy has gone down too. So that's good news for renewables, right? In the EU, a record 40% of the bloc's electricity came from renewables in the first half of this year. Today on The Big Fix, we're answering one of your questions about how solar technology is changing.
We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
The only option that we have is to succeed.
What we do now and in the next few years will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
The world's environment producer, Anna Kussmer, is here. Anna, who's the listener and what's their question you're tackling this week?
Hey, Marco. So today we hear from Steve Smith. He lives in Portland, Oregon.
I listen to the world on Oregon Public Broadcasting, KOPB-FM.
Steve says he knows that solar has gotten a lot cheaper, but he wants to know if the technology has also improved.
My question is, are there any technological advances that are making solar panels not only cheaper, but better, as in producing more power with smaller arrays? Thanks very much.
Good question. So first of all, Anna, is Steve right? Has solar gotten a lot cheaper?
Steve is absolutely right. The price of solar has dropped 80 to 90% in the last 10 years. There's been a lot of investment in improving the way that panels get made and a much bigger demand, which has allowed the production to get a lot more efficient. There's just a much bigger economy of scale, which makes it cheaper to make each solar panel.
So price has gone down. What about Steve's question, though? Have solar panels actually also gotten better?
To Steve's specific question, solar cell technology has improved around 25% in the last decades. However, some of the biggest improvements in solar technology haven't been in the panels themselves. Here's Chris Roucher. He's a solar expert at Sunrun. That's the U.S.'s largest home solar company.
Really, the innovations have been in all of the things surrounding the solar.
Things like the racks that are used to put panels on top of roofs, the machines that convert the energy coming into the panels into energy that your home can use. But the biggest improvements, says Roucher, have been in the batteries.
Batteries have gotten cheaper, but they've also gotten smaller and more efficient. And there has been some really unbelievable improvements in the software and the brains that control the batteries as well.
The system as a whole is able to capture and store a lot more energy for longer.
Anna, has this better technology allowed for more solar to pop up on home roofs around the world?
Yes. So the better technology and particularly the cost has helped small solar projects expand around the world. It's helped to create thousands more solar-powered microgrids, and these are these small, isolated grids that don't need to be connected to the larger grid. About half of them globally are solar-powered. But even though they are coming down in price a lot, it doesn't mean they're affordable to those that need them most. Here's Takahiro Kawahara. He's from Bloomberg's Green Energy Research Arm.
Even though the cost of solar gets cheaper and cheaper, from the perspectives of the rural consumers, electricity of solar microgrids is too expensive.
Kawahara just wrote a report on microgrids that looked at their use in poorer countries like Uganda, Nigeria, Indonesia, and the Philippines, and some other countries where this technology is really taking off. And he says besides costs coming down, the most important advancements for these poorer countries is policy. These countries have improved their systems of regulations and subsidies, which have allowed microgrids to bring electricity to many places that have previously not had it. So the technology getting better and the cost coming down are important. But he says another really essential part of it is government support and regulation.
So, Anna, just to get back to Steve's original question, solar panels are a bit better. Everything else surrounding the panels has gotten a lot better, more efficient, and price has gone down. But it still comes down to that cost, microgrids and solar power getting to the people who need it most. You got to have it subsidized somehow, right?
Yeah, Marco, that's exactly it.
The world's Anna Kussmer, thanks so much.
You bet.
If you've got a question for our environment desk to report on, send us an email to climate@theworld.org. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A few years ago in Guatemala, they attempted a radical experiment. A citizen-backed movement aimed to root out corruption in the highest levels of government. The United Nations backed the project. It got off to a strong start. A prosecutor from Colombia named Ivan Velasquez got involved. He worked with Guatemalan officials to bring corruption charges against more than 100 officials, including a sitting president. But just as the investigations appeared to be gathering steam, the Trump White House made sure the project was shut down. It now appears that a quid pro quo was at the heart of the deal. That's according to a new investigation by our partners at the Center for Investigative Reporting's Reveal. Reveal's Ana Yancy Diaz-Cortez joins us from Berkeley. To start us off, Ana Yancy, tell us about Ivan Velasquez. Some have called him the Robert Mueller of Guatemala. I don't know if that's the best analogy, but you sat down with him. Who is he and what did he set out to do?
Ivan Velasquez is someone who in Colombia went after the Uribe administration in Colombia for links to corruption and paramilitary groups. He worked in the Supreme Court. He's a pioneering prosecutor, a crusader in Latin America. And shortly after he arrives in Guatemala, he does something audacious. He wiretaps the president, then President Otto Perez Molina, and finds deep ties to corruption and recommends that he go before a judge, and he throws him in jail. So Guatemala is kind of left without a president.
I mean, it's kind of a complicated arrangement. And you asked Velasquez if he had any idea what he was getting into when he started this anti-corruption campaign in Guatemala. Here's what he told you.
En realidad, yo no sabía la situación tan compleja que me esperaba.
Velasquez describes himself as someone who hadn't left Colombia, didn't really have intention of leaving Colombia. So he's like, in reality, I had no idea how complex the situation would be.
So the Obama administration and then Vice President Joe Biden were big backers of this commission. When he was president, Obama sent Biden to Guatemala several times, offering millions in aid that was tied to the fight against corruption.
Here's the deal. We believe that there's a lot more we can and should do in the United States to deal with the root causes of this problem.
And with the U.S. and U.N. backing, the Anti-Corruption Commission made real progress in prosecuting wrongdoing. It shined a spotlight on bribes taken by Guatemala's then president and many others. But then, Ana Yance, you bring us to 2016. There was a changing of the guard in Washington with the arrival of Trump, and in Guatemala with this new president, Jimmy Morales. He's a celebrity right-wing populist who rose to power with no experience in government. That's going to sound familiar to Americans. Before becoming president, Morales also had a weekly comedy show.
¿Ustedes saben cuál es la parte más sensible del cuerpo de una mujer? Termina en...
Ana Yancy, what's going on here? What was Jimmy Morales' show about?
So Jimmy Morales is someone who... The whole opening of his show is him, you know, on a flying carpet. You know, in the span of minutes, he makes fun of indigenous people. He makes fun of Afro-Guatemalans. He dresses up in blackface as a clown as he's telling this joke about the female anatomy. And this crude jokester comedian, very famous in Guatemala, that kind of rises to power from this stardom and becomes the president.
But then Velasquez starts investigating Morales' campaign funding. That doesn't go very well. Velasquez gets kicked out of Guatemala. How does that happen?
As Velasquez starts to investigate the Morales family more, he finds irregularities in campaign financing, and he starts to go after him for that, and he demands that Morales and his family stand before a judge. And this is when, you know, Morales is not going to have that, and he declares him persona non grata, and Morales appears on national television with, like, the military behind him and sends jeeps with mounted artillery to the commission's offices to circle the offices and effectively kick Velasquez out, and a year later completely shut down the commission to the point that the building is scheduled to be demolished this year.
Wow. Now, this is where we get to the heart of your investigation, Anayatsi. You and others at Reveal have determined that when Velasquez, the crusading anti-corruption prosecutor, was tossed out of Guatemala, it was part of a quid pro quo with the Trump White House, a favor granted in return for something. What did you find?
Right. What Velasquez alleges and what the timeline shows and the lobbying documents that correspond to that timeline show is that after this persona non grata speech that happens, you see a change in Washington. You don't see that support for the commission anymore. You see Nikki Haley come to Guatemala and tell Velasquez, you need to tone it down and not be in the paper every day. Now, a few days after that, we see Nikki Haley at AIPAC with Jimmy Morales announcing that along with the move of the United States Embassy to Jerusalem, Guatemala was the first country to follow suit and move the Guatemalan Embassy to Jerusalem as well. This is what brings them together and what Velasquez talks about, people coming back to him and describing Morales saying to Trump, you know, you have Mueller in the United States, I have Velasquez in Guatemala, get Ivan Velasquez and the commission out of my hair in exchange for a pliant migration policy into Guatemala.
So just make that plain. What was the nature of the quid pro quo between Trump and Morales, as you and Reveal have found?
To be clear, there is no smoking gun, or at least not yet, that we've found. We have done a lot of investigating. We are deep in this timeline. But what Velasquez alleges is that throughout this, the quid pro quo was get Ivan Velasquez and the commission out of my hair in exchange for an open door migration policy into Guatemala from the Trump administration to the Morales administration. And what the timeline says shortly after is that then the safe third party agreement is signed and we see Morales in D.C. at the White House and Trump calling this relationship terrific and tremendous.
The U.S. State Department has also told you there's no evidence of a quid pro quo. Regardless, President Trump now seems pretty pleased with relations with Guatemala.
We've had a tremendous relationship over the last 2 years on the border. Guatemala has been terrific. We've signed agreements with Guatemala that have been tremendous in terms of really both countries. Excellent.
So where does this leave anti-corruption efforts in Guatemala and all the Guatemalans desperate to flee their country for a decent life somewhere else?
Exactly, Marco. And where that leaves is that Jimmy Morales is no longer president. This year, in January 2020, Alejandro Giammattei is now the president of Guatemala. And, you know, a lot of people talk about this taking the country back decades. Since this commission was kicked out of the country, we kind of have seen a return to the way things used to be. Guatemala's new president, Alejandro Giammattei, has deep ties to drug mafias, to former military officials. I mean, he used to oversee the prison system, and the commission came after him for illegally killing prisoners. And since he took office, 12 human rights defenders have been killed in Guatemala, and others have had to flee the country. So it's really kind of a return to the past in some ways, to the time of like a military strongman in Guatemala. And it's a really scary time for a lot of people. At the same time, there is this sense that the commission was set up to embolden and to create a sense of culture around constitutional law, and that now it's Guatemalan civil society's turn to demand accountability and to lead anti-corruption efforts.
Ana Yancy Diaz-Cortez of Reveal at the Center for Investigative Reporting. She's been speaking with us about an apparent quid pro quo that brought Guatemala's anti-corruption project to an end. Ana Yancy, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco. Thanks for having me.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way. You're listening to The World. The Chinese government has funded Confucius Institutes at U.S. universities for years. Critics say they're bad for academic freedom and free expression.
It's been really difficult to have the Chinese government basically represented on campus and forwarding, in many cases, direct propaganda.
U.S.-China tensions showing up on college campuses. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World from PRX and GBH. Riots erupted overnight in Colombia's capital, Bogota. Hundreds of people turned out in the streets after a video of a man being assaulted and repeatedly tased by police was widely shared. The man later died in police custody. The protests last night got violent and at least 7 people were killed. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has been following the story. Jorge, what do we know about the original incident that sparked these protests?
Hey, Marco. The incident centered around a man. His name was Javier Ordóñez. He was in his 40s. He had 2 kids. He was a lawyer by training and made a living driving a taxi. And on Tuesday night, he was drinking with some friends at a private residence. And then they went out to procure more alcohol. And that's when they ran into 2 police officers. And that is where the video comes from. And I want to play you about 15 seconds of this video. But I just want you to know, Marco, ahead of time, that what we're about to hear is very disturbing.
Hace rato dijo, por favor, está tranquilo. Sí, ¿por qué le hacen más? ¿Por qué le hacen más?
Jorge, what's going on there?
Yeah, what we just heard was Javier laying underground, being pinned down by 2 police officers, and he is begging them, please stop, please stop. Then you hear the taser, and then you hear the person who's recording the video telling the police officers, he is telling you to stop. Why are you still doing this? This video lasts more than 2 minutes, and I counted maybe about a dozen times that the police officers tased him. I didn't go back and get a more exact figure because, honestly, just the first time that I was watching it, it is an absolutely repulsive video and makes you sick to your stomach.
So another case of violent police behavior caught on tape. How exactly did this lead to these riots overnight?
Well, the following day on Wednesday, Javier's family called for a vigil in their neighborhood, which is where this happened. It's a western district of the city. It's called Engatiwa. It's near the airport. And it was peaceful until about nightfall. And then at nightfall is when people started protesting outside of the police post where Javier was taken to. They started smashing the windows. And then from there, it just erupted and spread to other parts of the city. And in the end, 7 civilians were killed. About 250 people were injured. And some 50 of them were injured actually by gunfire. So it's still being debated who was firing, but many witnesses say that it was the police officers who were drawing their arms.
What's been the response from officials in Bogota?
The mayor of Bogota, Claudia Lopez, she was unequivocal in saying that she believes that this is not an isolated incident, that this is a symptom of a systematic issue with the police, not only in Bogota, but also in Colombia. And then also the country's defense minister also said, yes, this is a problem, but also the protests themselves generate new problems.
I mean, it's always hard to assess the momentum of protests, especially when they get violent. But do you expect that they're going to continue? Do you have a sense of the level of anger in Bogota?
I think people are very angry. There are some parallels that we can see with what happened with George Floyd in the United States. Now, Javier Ordóñez is not Afro-Colombian. He is mestizo like I am and like most people in Colombia are. But this is a case in which police officers were recorded holding their knees to a man who is very clearly showing that that he's being submissive. And the other parallel is the pandemic. Bogota, the mayor, Claudia Lopez, has been very strict and very proactive in physical isolation measures. People have been locked in for most of the last 6 months. Even through August, many sections of the city were on very strict lockdown. So the city seems to be like a pot of hot water that is starting to boil over. So is it going to continue? It seems like it. And the police, at the very least, seem to think that it is, because overnight the police called police officers from other cities of the country, hundreds of police officers. So I think that this is quite a volatile situation, and it's likely to continue.
We'll keep watching closely. The World's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
When police in Rochester, New York, apprehended Daniel Prude back in March, he was going through a mental health crisis. Not long after Prude was subdued by officers, he was dead. Police say he died from, quote, complications of asphyxia in the setting of physical restraint. The Rochester police chief and command staff resigned this past week. Experts say, though, up to a quarter of people killed by police officers have some sort of mental illness. Another sobering statistic, about 40% of adults with serious mental illness will come into contact with the criminal justice system during their lifetimes. So do we need to rethink policing and mental illness in America? One city that has already done that is the Swedish capital, Stockholm. Since 2015, a mental health ambulance has been on hand to deal with emergency psychiatric issues. Andreas Karlborg is the managing director of North Stockholm Psychiatry, and he helped create the mental health ambulance service there. Andreas, what kind of cases is the mental health ambulance used for in Stockholm?
So when we started this project in 2015, the main priority case was suicidal behavior. But in reality, we now deal with a quite broad spectrum of psychiatric disorders, everything from acute psychosis, delusional behavior with agitation, as well as serious suicidal behavior.
And when an individual is in a situation like this and somebody calls you, are they calling the police or are they calling the mental health ambulance? How are you alerted?
What will happen is there is a common number, the alarm center, that will take the call from maybe the public or the patient or relatives or whatever, and then they will dispatch the psychiatric ambulance and in some cases also the police. So they will decide whether this is a case for the psychiatric emergency services.
And how is generally the mental health ambulance staffed? Who's inside when it shows up? And typically, what's the routine?
The ambulance is staffed with 3 people. So 2 nurses, they are specialists in psychiatric care. And then there is also an ambulance driver with a specific knowledge of ambulance services and emergency services in the region.
So the service, the mental health ambulance, has been operating since 2015. Why was it created?
Well, there were actually two issues. One was that the patient and the patient organization felt that they didn't receive the proper medical assessment because they were usually dealt with by the police. And the police was frustrated because they felt that they had to deal with issues that they didn't have the proper training for and didn't really have the time to spend on. So I would say that was two of the main factors that motivated us to start this project.
Mm. You have no doubt heard the calls to defund the police in the U.S. What a lot of people are really talking about is reallocating resources to city departments that can do the jobs like mental health care that police may not be trained to do. So did Stockholm have that debate when the mental health ambulance was proposed? Was it about deviating resources from the police department to another department?
No, not really, because this ambulance wasn't about taking sources from the police to the emergency psychiatric services. But at the same time, the police felt and are still feeling, but less so, that a lot of their resources are used to deal with psychiatric patients outside in the public. So this was something that they raised and felt that was a really big problem for them.
In cases where police do accompany the mental health ambulance staff, is it for what kind of cases? Is it for violent cases?
Yeah, so in about 50% of the cases that the psychiatric ambulance deal with, there will be a cooperation with the police. In some cases, the patient can have a history of violent behavior, and that would be a reason for bringing the police with them. And sometimes the police is also dispatched by the alarm center along with the psychiatric ambulance. But in most of the cases, the police can leave and the patient will be taken care of fully by the staff in the ambulance.
So what's been the overall effect of having the psychiatric ambulance in Stockholm?
First of all, if you look from the patient's perspective, the patients have really felt that there's a less stigma of having these problems. The quality of the care provided outside a hospital setting has increased because now they are taken care of by trained healthcare professionals instead of the police. Also, the police has communicated that they feel that this is a big relief for them because they now have access to healthcare professional in the pre-hospital setting that can, in most cases, deal with these patients and take care of them in a proper way. Previously, when the police handled that, they would always take these patients to the ER. Mm. Now we can let about 30% of the patients, after being assessed by the nurses, they can stay at home and we can provide them with contact with their outpatient clinic and prepare them so they can have a proper follow-up in an outpatient setting.
So the ambulance, as I said, it's been in place in Stockholm since 2015. Is there just one or several ambulances now, and is it just Stockholm?
The project started in 2015, but after about 1.5 years, it was decided it should be a regular part of the emergency medical services in the region. So there's one ambulance in Stockholm. It's operational from 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 2 o'clock at night. That's where we have most of the alarms coming in. There is a room for another ambulance in the region, but it's hard to find proper staff with the right knowledge. But in the near future, we might start up another one.
Andreas Karlborg is the managing director of North Stockholm Psychiatry. He's been speaking to us about the mental health ambulance that Stockholm has been using instead of police to deal with emergency psychiatric situations. This is really interesting, Andreas. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Whether it's police brutality in Bogota or psychiatrists in Stockholm now attending to cases that police there used to deal with, the world helps you understand how problems in policing and justice are dealt with around the globe and how all that connects back to our own communities here in the U.S. If you want to explore these stories more deeply, visit us at theworld.org. The rising tension between the U.S. and China is playing out, among other places, at American colleges and universities. The Trump administration has taken aim at what's known as Confucius Institutes. These are Chinese-funded cultural and language programs set up on U.S. college campuses. Administrators find themselves caught in the middle. Some say academic freedom itself is at stake. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Lots of countries have centers in the U.S. that promote their culture and language. But the Confucius Institutes China launched in 2004 are embedded within U.S. universities. The Chinese government provides funding and in some cases has a say in who the teachers are and what they teach.
It's been really difficult to have at our universities, at our schools here, the Chinese government basically represented on campus and forwarding, in many cases, direct propaganda.
Canadian Tibetan Laden Taitong directs the Tibet Action Institute. It's been helping students organize against Confucius Institutes for years. They say China uses the institutes to surveil Chinese dissidents and suppress discussion of topics China considers controversial, like Uyghurs, Taiwan, Tibet, and the Dalai Lama. They got the University of Massachusetts Boston to close its Confucius Institute in 2019.
I think since the Russian influence in the U.S., the last U.S. election, I think people understand more that foreign governments can actually influence hearts and minds in the United States and other countries in a way that can have meaningful and perhaps long-lasting and damaging results.
But even Taitong has been surprised by the recent dramatic escalation in the State Department's stance on Confucius Institutes.
It's almost head-spinning how quickly things are happening.
Last month, the State Department designated the Confucius Institute U.S. Center in D.C. a foreign mission, requiring it to report its activities and funding. Then last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo got this question from Fox News host Lou Dobbs.
At last count, there were 75 of the so-called Confucius Institutes in K through 12 American colleges and university campuses. How many will there be by the end of this year?
I hope the answer is zero, Lou. I think that everyone's coming to see the risk associated with them and the recruitment of spies and collaborators inside of those institutions. I think these institutions can see that, and I'm hopeful we will get them all closed out before the end of this year.
It's not clear what power Pompeo has to make that happen. Edward McCord says the U.S. government has no evidence of undue Chinese influence on campuses. He's a professor emeritus at the George Washington University, and he helped set up their Confucius Institute.
The rationale for it is just all wrong, actually. They talked about them being propaganda in the classrooms and a malign influence on campuses. There's just no proof of that whatsoever. I think they just want to do something anti-Chinese.
That's a common theory. Professor Marshall Salins was one of the Confucius Institute's early academic opponents. His activism led his school, the University of Chicago, to close its institute in 2014.
The discourse about Confucius Institutes changed from a question of intellectual freedom to espionage, and this became a right-wing American cause.
And while Salins agrees that Confucius Institutes should close, he says closing at the behest of the U.S. government is problematic.
They're letting the American government interfere in the curriculum about what can be taught, which is exactly the same kind of totalitarian relationship of the state to the institutions that the Chinese have.
The spokesman of the Confucius Institute U.S. Center in D.C., the one that's been designated a foreign mission, says this is all a misunderstanding.
You know, people are throwing out these accusations, but a quick fact check shows that it's just not the case.
Eric Eging says he speaks from personal experience. He took classes at George Mason University's Confucius Institute in Virginia before graduating in 2018.
There have been programs that featured the Dalai Lama at universities that housed Confucius Institutes. At no point did the Confucius Institutes try to intercede or pressure them not to hold these events. There's been Confucius Institute events that covered topics like Tibet or other things that might seem critical to the Chinese government.
So Eging says students across the U.S. shouldn't be deprived of classes they wouldn't otherwise have access to.
It's just very tragic that this kind of misplaced frustrations are going after a language program instead of being applied to the areas that there are disagreements between our two countries.
Yiging says people need to be able to communicate with each other, regardless of their differences or disagreements. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
A re-traumatizing moment in Beirut today, a little more than a month since that terrible explosion at the city's port. Again, at that same port today, a huge fire sent a column of black smoke across Beirut's skyline. Last month's explosion at the port killed more than 190 people and destroyed whole sections of Lebanon's capital. It was not clear right away what started today's fire. Apparently, oil and tires being stored there were fueling the blaze. Authorities tried to reassure the public there was no danger of another explosion, but people are in shock, says Gul Rehman. He's with the aid group CARE Lebanon.
All the city was in the state of panic, and to the city we can smell still burnt oil.
Rehman points out that many Lebanese were already struggling financially even before the port explosion because of the country's economic crisis. He says he was relieved late this afternoon when firefighters appeared to bring the fire under control. There's still a massive amount of work, though, to help people in Lebanon recover from one crisis after another. Musicians have been making their own contributions to the recovery efforts since that port explosion on August 4th. The World's Bianca Hillier has been listening in.
Lebanese singer Didi Fox was 1,600 miles from Beirut when the calamitous explosion happened. Didi was in Dubai, but her family was back in Lebanon.
Our house is 4 kilometers away from the explosion. It was like hard to believe that this actually happening.
Didi was relieved to learn her family was out of the city at the time and was safe, but their homes were badly damaged.
All the damage was material. All the windows blew up. All the glass was shattered. And it was the same for my house, my grandparents' house, my uncle's house, everybody there.
Didi Fox's life usually revolves around music. Her success in the UAE led to her becoming the first Middle Eastern female to place on U.S. Billboard charts. But in the weeks immediately following the blast, the pop star wasn't thinking about writing a song. She was fundraising and sending money to local Beirut businesses who needed support.
Seeing the aftermath was really traumatizing. So I wasn't really thinking about music. I was thinking, what is music going to do at this point? They really need immediate and urgent help.
That help is still needed. An estimated 300,000 people remain without a home. But now, about 1 month after the blast, musicians like Didi Fox are starting to sing. In a new song called Little Girl, Didi Fox and other Lebanese musicians relay a message of hope for Beirut. The lyrics tell the story of a child whose dreams have been shattered, but is told to not be scared because Lebanon will rebuild. Producing the song and music video was a family affair. Didi's father wrote the lyrics. Her cousin appears as the little girl in the video, and her sister edited the whole thing together. It was also the first time Didi Fox has released a song in her mother tongue, Arabic.
Definitely out of respect and as a tribute, the song had to be in Arabic.
Didi's tribute song isn't the only musical addition to the recovery efforts in Beirut. Lebanese-Australian singer Jihad Dibab got started on a song the very night of the blast.
You know, I had so many emotions, and for me, a way to process my emotions is just to start writing.
Within a week, Dibab released a song and accompanying video called Lebanon, I Love You.
Lebanon, I love you.
Even though I hardly know you.
Beirut, I love you.
Even though I hardly know you.
Notice that the lyrics there say, I hardly know you. Dibab was raised in Australia and only moved to the Middle East a few years ago to reconnect with his roots. He lives in Abu Dhabi now and says Lebanese nationals living abroad have been the ones connecting with his track.
Especially from the Australian Lebanese community. They seem to really identify with the lyrics.
Another song put out to support Beirut comes from Lebanese composer Guy Manoukian, who teamed up with American-Haitian musician Wyclef Jean to produce a song called Immortal.
Yeah.
prominent Algerian singer Khalid also released a tribute track. Its title translates to "Her name is Beirut." Profits from that song will be donated to Lebanon's Red Cross, but performers themselves need support too. Fadi Tabal is a Lebanese musician and founder of TuneFork Recording Studios in Beirut. He was at TuneFork's office, less than a mile from the port, at the time of the explosion.
We were having a smoke in the living room, and then we heard the big noises, and in a matter of seconds, we saw the huge mushroom. The door crushed, it was made of glass, and almost everything in the living room got destroyed. It was like a uber apocalyptic.
Tabal says everyone inside was okay, and the studio's recording rooms were unscathed because of their reinforced walls. But other artists are facing serious loss, so Tabal created the Beirut Musicians Fund.
So I was like, you know, I'm going to do a comprehensive list of all the gears these people lost.
Tabal is trying to replace musicians' instruments after so many were damaged by the blast. He's raised about $17,000 so far, halfway to his goal. But Tabal isn't expecting artists who lived through the blast to turn out any sort of tribute song soon. He says he questions the ethics behind such tracks.
Sometimes it feels like you're using a situation to get your name out there, so this feels weird. But at the same time, on the other hand, if you're a big name and you're doing that, it actually puts Beirut on the map, and it's important not to normalize all the bad situations that happened. So it's kind of a double-edged sword.
Pop star Didi Fox isn't collecting any profits from her tribute track, and singer Jihad Dabab directs people to donate at the end of his music video. They say their songs are about bringing people together to heal. Tabal says watching artists support each other from within Beirut and around the world has been refreshing.
It's really nice to see everybody like just trying to help each other out. It's beautiful to see that.
For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us anytime online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay strong, stay safe. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Beirut.